And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides again. And this being another Thursday evening, we're going to have interviews with Nick Belayich as part of the supervisors' corral, the cultivators' ordinances that they're trying to cook up, and that are coming up on April 19th at the Board of Supervisors. Also, a bit on the Vanish the Vendors ordinance that received its first look, but not its first reading, at the Santa Cruz City Council on April 12th. I'll have more on that on Sunday. And, other stuff as well, so stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of bread lines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. Want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And welcome to the April 14th version of Bathrobe's Piers Broadsides, or edition, if you will. I'm Robert Norris, and you can call in to the show where I will answer you afterward, either by phone or possibly by commenting on the air. It appears very few people have taken that. I don't think anybody that I know of has actually wanted something put on the air that has resulting from a phone call that they sent me. But it's an option for you. If you find you feel there's not enough information, or there's misinformation, or a point of view is being ignored that should be there, I'm willing to consider it. 423-4833. 423-4833. That's also a number you can reach if you're concerned about maintaining the life of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Amy Goodman did a very nice kind of ad for us, or boost for us, at her Rio Theater appearance last night, but that doesn't give us a studio. And we don't actually ask to be given a studio. We want to rent one, but we need to have access to a studio space, 10 by 10 for a year, electricity, internet, bathroom, you know, all the modern amenities, but not really too much else. A separate entrance would be nice, but we can deal with what you offer us. We can even deal with the backyard. We can set up our own structure. But we need that. And I continue to put out this rather stock advertisement, if you will, because even though I continue this show, I really am concerned about the continuation of our radio collective. And unless we get some substantial support, I'm afraid it will go the way of the dodo. Anyway, I'm going to be talking at some length on Sunday when I have a longer show, assuming I have the oomph to do it, about the proposed downtown ordinance changes, which essentially amount to a vendor's begone ordinance and a redo of the display device ordinance. You know, those little printed brackets on the sidewalk, or dots. I guess at one time they were dots, another time they're brackets along Pacific Avenue that are the sort of performance pins, as I call them, the places where you're allowed to be in order to sing, dance, set up a table, petition. Those are the free speech spots. The rest is unfree. It's commercially preempted, even though public taxes pay for the sidewalks, even though the businesses have no say, theoretically, on what goes on the public sidewalks in terms of any kind of private ownership. Nonetheless, the city council, under the thumb of the Downtown Association, pretty much, is now considering a series of ordinances that will further deepen the commercialization of the downtown and limit the free space that people have to, as I think in the past I said, you have like 1% of the sidewalk to sit down on, even. And in terms of tabling and performing and vending, there was an expansion of space from 1% to 2% about 2 years ago. And then they cut it back again because they thought there were too many vendors. It's not entirely clear because their process is done behind closed doors. We don't know what criteria they use. They don't announce their decisions. They don't announce any public input. And we're going to be actually listening to a lot of the council debate. Hardly call it debate, actually. The council chatter on this issue and the lengthy presentation by the two staff members who have cooked up this latest monstrosity, Scott Collins and Julie Hendy. We aren't going to have them on today, probably much, maybe a little, because I've got other stuff that I want to play, and I really need a longer period of time to sound off adequately against these people. Or maybe I should take less time. You know, I'm always torn, because since, in a way, this whole procedure is likely a done deal, at least in terms of changing the minds and the hearts of the city council, there seems to be a little point in actually trying to mobilize people to go to city council, though my fellow activists always tell me, no, they could come to, they should go to city council. And I think there is some point in going to city council if you understand that your mission is like pretty futile if your objective is to change the minds of the council. If your objective is to reach, to some extent, the audience of the broader public, to reassert your right to be in the so-called public spaces at the city council and to express your opinions there, if your right interest is meeting activists, or just educating yourself on the latest shenanigans of the city council and the staff that runs the city council, then, you know, maybe it's worthwhile. Maybe it's worth doing. I tend to show up there sort of mechanically when these latest gouges on the public space are cooked up by smiling guys in business suits like Scott Collins, who is a nice enough guy, by the way. He actually tends to respond to my emails. I've asked for a meeting with him. He wants to do it by email. I'm hoping we can persuade him. We can sit down and go over the ordinances, again, not because I want to change his mind, but because I want to understand the process by which he's operating, who he talked to, why he chose one thing over another. not to mention who chose him to be God in this matter. I suppose the city council did, or the city manager, actually, who really runs the city, Martin Brunel. So just a few, just some preliminary comments on the downtown ordinances. Maybe actually I should begin with how the downtown ordinance debate ended, or the final resolution passed by the city council, which is essentially instructions for the city staff to bring back the draft ordinance as they presented it, with essentially very few changes, if any. I don't think there, I don't recall any specific changes. Maybe there were a few. Let's listen in. But actually, I'm going to interrupt this exciting review of the downtown ordinance conclusion, because on the line with me just calling in is Katzenjammer Keith McHenry, a co-founder of Who Not Bombs, and a recent jailbird checking out the latest accommodations of the Santa Cruz County Jail. Hi, Keith.
Hi, yeah. Everybody should go there. It's beautiful. People are often asked what happened about this arrest, people that have heard that it existed, happened. And essentially, so the original thing is several cops came, including Bush, and arrested me, and Sergeant Bush is the sergeant-at-arms at the city council.
And this was Keith, yesterday, I should say Tuesday, at the... You set up a pavilion in front of City Hall, which you were forced to move as a sort of the beginning of a memorial to Chris Bazor, right?
Yes, so we were doing Chris Bazor's memorial service, and we had to move around a lot. We had a lot of conversations with cops all day, and there was threats of arrest or citations for an event without a permit and tents without a permit and stuff like that. And then we, fortunately, everything came together, all the food came together, and we had gotten and they cleaned up the sidewalk where the memorial was going to be, the workers that are doing the anti-homeless landscaping, and then in front of City Hall.
But they did, Keith, they did move you away from the area slightly closer to the city council, and later on, as I noticed, they ribboned off large chunks of the outside area, which they've been doing regularly before each city council, but apparently there was also some youth event that was scheduled that they claimed was the basis for saying you couldn't be anywhere in the courtyard except perhaps on the bricks next to the sidewalk, right?
Correct, yeah. They were having like a service day, award ceremony, and a potluck, like hors d'oeuvres and stuff, and they actually told me that they didn't want homeless people, or our people is what they called them, coming up there and getting free food.
Who told you that?
And that was actually false alarm guy Chase that told me that.
Chase, the first alarm security guard.
Yeah. So he came up and told me that, and then he's the one that called in the cops apparently because they have this impression. He's the only one I told them that we might have 100 people there, and they came and told me that we might have 100 people there. And so, you know, that actually, had no idea what kind of people would be, you know, what the numbers were. It would be great if it was 100. But anyway, so Chris's memorial was, I had vases that I'd gotten, that Abby and I had gotten for another.
Before you go on to Chris's memorial, the significance of the 100 number, I think, is that sort of kicks in the requirement for a permit, which you weren't interested in getting into because the permit... At least many of us say in Santa Cruz, the Constitution is our permit, right?
Correct, yeah, and I actually have had bad experiences with permits in that, for me, this is my philosophical and practical and direct experience, is if you get permission from the government to do something that is your constitutional right, then they feel like they can take away that permission, and so essentially what I have found has happened is that you do... if you pretend like a permit is needed, and then you therefore request a permit, as I had mistakenly done in San Francisco in July of '88, then they give you the permit to take it away. And so you just open the door to the idea that the government is has the authority to let you do things, and then, of course, if they can let you do things, they can tell you not to do things, and then you are in this situation where they have this ability to claim that you applied for a permit and you had one, but now you don't have one, and therefore you should not do whatever First Amendment activity you're doing.
So, Keith,
I don't play the permit game anymore.
I got
that's
you.
My official personal policy, and what I encourage in books I've written and so on, because this stuff is our, we're just humans out here on Earth, and it's our right to go around and do things that are positive, as long as we're not, you know, like harming somebody, and, you know, and so that I was not harming anyone. I was.
So you set up, Keith, around noon, and immediately police began to appear. But you weren't really arrested until, 4 or 5 o'clock?
Yeah, I was arrested, I think about 15 to 4. Abby believed it was about 3:30, so it was roughly in that area, Abby being my partner, Abby Samuels. And she was there, so she might well be exact in her time, because she had gotten permission to leave work temporarily to go to this memorial service. And she was there and got in the Food Up Bombs truck to go down and get the chairs for the service from the Little Red Church that they were lending us. And the police arrived. I was trimming the flowers donated by, were the discarded flowers from Trader Joe's and putting them in the vases when three cops came and booting Sergeant Bush and arrested me for a warrant. And I ended up down at the jail getting booked and put in, and they took off my ankle bracelet. Whoops, I missed my turn.
Explain what your ankle bracelet is for.
So I had an issue of where I went out and I painted, returned the blue boxes that had been removed by the city for performance spaces on Pacific Avenue, because I believe that the 61 boxes that were originally there were not, I didn't think were reasonable. I don't think that the merchants that are against the performers on the street really understand what is going on. They have this, or if they do, they just basically are cruel. And, but they give the impression, when they speak, when the ones I've spoken to, that the performers leave trash all over, they harass people, they're violent, they do all these horrible things, and therefore we need to get rid of them. And so they have been making increasing number of rules to try to limit the ability of performers. And so they passed this ordinance like a year, maybe a year and a half ago now. The ordinance put out 61 boxes. They were supposed to be multicolored depending on the type of green speech you were supposed to engage in. And then, but they turned out to be blue. And then, about halfway through, 6 months later, they removed 30 of them at least and started ticketing people for not being within the blue boxes. And so they, I had friends getting ticketed for that, $350 tickets, people being harassed. So one day after Food Not Bombs, I went out and I put 33 of them back, because it's just blue spray paint with a little L-shaped bracket, which I traced and then cut stencils and then replaced them. And they videotaped that, and me and Abby Samuels got felony conspiracy and felony vandalism charges, arrested at the Freedom Sleepers sleep out one night for that, and then we had like a long court ordeal surrounding that. Eventually, I got 60 days work release, but for whatever, because of jail overcrowding, blah blah blah, something, whatever their trip is about that, it went down to 28 days. So I was supposed to wear an ankle bracelet for 28 days, and I was doing that. And so they arrest me for a warrant for not complying with the ankle bracelet, even though I had it on and it was in compliance. And the warrant actually technically was sent out right before I got the ankle bracelet, but didn't post before the courts. You know, I talked to the courts, actually went to court specifically to clear this up on March 30th. This and other issues related to it, like charges that didn't disappear, that were supposed to be dropped, that were also caught in the computer web, things of that nature, clarification on what was going on.
So could we summarize by saying that this is essentially a computer error by the courts? I'm sorry, say that again, Q. Say that again.
It was a communications error between the courts and the sheriff's department.
And so you were falsely arrested at this Chris Bazaar Memorial, right?
Right at the beginning of it, yeah. Just I'd say roughly between 30 and 15 minutes before the memorial that I initiated and helped organize and plan. And the sheriff's department, when they found out it was a mistake, was kind of freaked out by that a little bit, apparently, because they had wanted to meet with me, which I talked to them about how this mistake could possibly happen. And this was when I was getting released. And
how long did it take you to get released?
I was arrested, like I say, about 3:30. I was then released at 12 the next day.
So, in other words, what had the they didn't discover the mistake till then, or they just held you for the hell of it?
No, it was Abby, because I'm my own lawyer too, so I couldn't go into court to argue for myself. But Abby spent the whole morning trying to figure out what went wrong, where, and she got conflicting reports from different places and stuff, and eventually cleared it up, figured out through row 20 at the courthouse what the situation was, and so after this back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, we finally, she was able to convince the sheriff's department that they didn't really have a warrant for my arrest, and that this should be cleared up. And the sheriff's department then really released me, but then like it took less than 2 hours to get out after they finally realized that what Abby was saying was accurate.
So you were falsely imprisoned for a total of, well, I don't know, it sounds like 21 hours or something?
Yeah, something like that,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was really interesting. So the process was the whole process was interesting because when I got into the facility, when I finally got into to the dorm, whatever it's called, people there all knew Chris, or many of them, and so they all started talking about Chris and his whole thing. It was really quite fascinating.
Tell the audience who Chris is.
Okay, so Chris was his nickname was Wheelchair Chris. He was lived on the streets for many years. He was disabled, had a brain injury from a car wreck that killed the driver of the car when he was, they were hit at the fish hook by a semi truck. And, he therefore would end up in a wheelchair. His father was the founding editor of the Santa Cruz Weekly, Buzz. And, his mother was famous in the community for being one of two women killed by a business person, a shop owner in Aptos, back when Chris was 10 years old. And many people told me they had gone to elementary school with him. Several people in the jail had grown up with him. It was very interesting. He died. He's 50 years old. He died on March 17th. And in a wheelchair outside of Bank of the West at Water and Mission and Pacific, that intersection. So that's what happened, and then I got out, and Abby picked me up, And today I had to go to court. I just got a letter saying I had a warrant for my arrest just this afternoon when the mail was delivered to our house. A little late.
What kind of a charge did they cause the warrant?
It was the warrant failure to get the, you know, basically it was a warrant failure to get the ankle bracelet that I actually had on.
So. I see. So they apparently a little nearsighted in noticing whether you had the ankle bracelet on.
Yeah, something was going wrong. So.
Anything happened in jail, Keith, that you found of interest?
Yeah, I've been in a lot of jails. This jail is really really well organized compared to other jails in the U.S. I've been in. What was very touching was the inmates were really, really so kind. I've never seen such kind inmates when I got there. One person helped me make my bed. And then people in San Francisco were, you know, when they knew we were food not bombs, they were, like, supportive and stuff. But these people were really gentle, cooperative, even with each other. There was no arguing or anything. I was surprised at the level of, if you're lucky, you get a jumpsuit and some socks and slippers. But here they give you, and one blanket. And then the mattress. But here they give you three blankets. They give you shorts, really nice quality underwear. They give you two towels. You get an actual plastic mug and plastic spoon that's reusable. They have like a hot water dispenser, like in the, like a coffee urn in the pod. And I thought that, oh, the jailers were, the deputies were really patient and, you could tell you weren't supposed to defy them, but they weren't like in San Francisco, they're yelling at everybody and stuff like that. And the sad thing was that most of the inmates were essentially people who had been driving under the influence of something and had had some problem. And so that's really sad because or warrants. But there was like nobody in my area that had actually done too much other than that. I mean, I think it is dangerous to be driving around under influence. That should never happen, and people should not do that ever. But, so that was kind of a sad comment that people are so out of it that they drive, you know, there's no mass transit. People get trashed for whatever's going reason, and they're very, low-income people, and then they have to get from point A to point B, they got to drive. And so, you know, a lot of that could be remedied with either having not having all the stress and stuff. Of course, some people will always be drunk or stoned or whatever, and that's their right. But they should have ways for you to get around without, needing to risk people's lives by driving.
So you're still currently banned from Pacific Avenue, except for Food Not Bombs this weekend. And also, I guess you've decided that the ban on you on Pacific Avenue does not include a flyering, right? You did some flyering and to educate the public around this Vanish the Vendors ordinance.
I'm not allowed to loiter on Pacific Ave, and I can walk across it. So I did some walking back and across to post flyers in other places, and then I'd go by. I would give flyers to vendors that were at the corner of, like a Cooper. I talked to a jeweler when I was walking past Cooper and Pacific, and then I talked to some artists at SoCal and Pacific on my way by. So, yeah, I can't loiter or go up and down Pacific Avenue, but I can cross it according to the judge, and so that's really good. And then it should be able to walk on it, because what the hell does returning blue boxes have anything to do with anything?
Keith, that lasts for how long? How long is this probation no-go?
I mean, it's January 26th of 2017.
Oh, boy. So you got another whole year of being banned from loitering on Pacific Avenue.
Yeah, so that's cool. Then today I just paid all my restitution, all my court costs, all my sheriff's costs, everything, cleared up all warrants and everything got an order basically that none of these paperwork problems are to occur again in the future, but who knows if that's true. But I just wanted to get everything off the board so there was no new mistake. So that's my theory there.
But what about this additional warrant that came in?
Well, that was cleared up. The Sheriff's Department issued a statement saying that that was not a real warrant and everything is okay.
So is this probation going to cut seriously into your ability to, I don't know, set up a city hall, to fly around Pacific Avenue? It doesn't seem like it, but...
No, it won't have any... it doesn't really have any interference with my daily life, actually, at all.
What about the arrest? What about the arrest?
The arrest turned out to be a good thing in that I meant I didn't have to pay money for, you know, like 6 more days of ankle bracelet, and I'm, you know, once you do that, and you don't have to wear the ankle bracelet anymore, so I'm... Now I could just go around without calling CAP and all that stuff. So that actually ended up being really good.
So you're not going to sue the city for false imprisonment?
No, I don't give a crap about that stuff anymore. I used to sue all the time, but I don't do it anymore.
I got you.
So, yeah. I better go because I'm at my set of Food Up on Story Stage.
And we've been talking with?
This is Keith McHenry, and you can get more information at foodupon.net.
Thank you, Keith.
Okay, take care, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
He's bound for glory.
Sammy Walker and Phil Oakes, Bound for Glory. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. This was pre-recorded, but it was pre-recorded on the same day, April 14th, 2016, when it is being broadcast. If you want to reach me, I'm Robert Norris. With any comments on the show, questions about what you're hearing, you can give a call to 831-423-4833. That's 423-4833, and you'll receive a call back, probably not during the showtime, but sometime. That was, as I said before, Bound for Glory. We're going to go back now to the Downtown Ordinance Review. We're actually not reviewing much of anything except one small part of the rather pernicious downtown ordinances, which criminalize such things as asking for a dime after dark, even if you're only doing so silently by sitting downtown with a sign that says, "Please help." That's a crime in Santa Cruz. Do it twice in 6 months, and you're up for a year in jail. And some people have served time for that kind of crime. Panhandling is considered a serious, serious offense in Santa Cruz, if repeated. The idea being to, I don't know, maybe send a message to poor people, your kind is not wanted on Pacific Avenue. We don't allow that kind of First Amendment activity because it embarrasses us, or we're afraid it'll drive away the tourists, or it annoys the workers at the bookshop Coonerty. That was the reason we got these anti-homeless, no sitting in your car and reading a book in the parking garages or the parking lots ordinance. Anyway, it is a downtown ordinance review of a very limited number of ordinances, primarily the ones created by Don Lane and Pamela Comstock that essentially set up these performance pens marked on the sidewalk. And we'll hear the end of this discussion, which will then give a recommendation to or a direction to the staff as to what to return with in 2 weeks when there will be a formal consideration of an ordinance, which, as I said, is like shit through a goose. It's likely to pass without much. If 100 people speak out against it, they'll be, you know, reduced to 30-second speeches each. That seems to be the Matthews approach. She reduced oral communications to 1 minute each because she said she wanted to, quote, get through the agenda. Of course, the whole point of a city councilman is not to get through the agenda. It is to allow matters adequate discussion and consideration and allow the public time to speak, something that, of course, she understands is not really true anymore, if it ever was. Probably not. Because they aren't listening anyway. Public has no power to change them except through the process of voting. The other kinds of processes, the recall, are expensive and unlikely. Direct action rarely happens, though it has on occasion at Santa Cruz City Council. That is to say, massive numbers of people expressing their outrage in sufficiently outspoken terms that the council takes a step back. I think Mike Rotkin has described this as a fascist approach. Actually, what it is it's a counter-fascist approach. Anyway, let's hear some of this. And this is, again, the last few minutes of the Santa Cruz City Council's consideration, or I should say rubber stamping, of the staff's downtown ordinance review. Now, this whole thing can be found, by the way, online. Just go to Santa Cruz City Council meetings and click under audio video files and then go to April 12th and you'll find this. But you'll also find this if you stay tuned.
We have a comment from PD as well.
This is Vice Chief.
I mean, Rick Martinez, Deputy Chief of Police Operations Division, which means I have everybody in uniform and all those people that were tasked with enforcing this, which was a problem, simply because when challenged, and challenged in terms of what performance was versus what panhandling was or what vending was, it wasn't simply an argument. It was a challenge that would have required a use of force to actually enforce. People were refusing to sign citations. people are looking to challenge the police department on what we deem to be administrative violations and what the city attorney actually deemed to be really questionable enforcement, especially when it came to trying to interpret something as simple as performance.
Interesting that even the vice chief suggests the police force considers the use of force to be the alternative that his force wants to use to enforce ordinances that he thinks should be enforced, but that even the city attorney suggests has a questionable validity, that is to say, the current ordinances. And what they're really talking about here is a little discussed aspect of this new ordinance change. For the last 7 years, actually longer, way back in the early 2000s, the great hero, Sergeant Butchie Baker, well known for abusing homeless people and who 10 women accused of fondling or improperly searching them, arrested and confiscated the property of Mike True, a local performer who was... I think he was either selling his own stuff or offering it for donation. And he won some money from the city because he was offering his own artwork, and it was First Amendment protected. This was further ratified and guaranteed by a City of Sparks decision in 2009 or so, in which... Well, it was used by Robin, a local artist, who went directly to the city attorney and said, I intend to display my art. I intend to put price tags on my artwork. And by that he meant his paintings, I believe. And I don't want to be hassled. And here's the reason. He showed the decision. And then city attorney John Barisoni, our new city attorney, then assistant city attorney, it's Tony Condotti. He agreed, but he did not publicize this, nor did he really advise the police department of it, as far as I could see. So police began, or continued, harassing people, as they often do, by claiming they have expanded authority to do things that they have no authority to do, that violate people's constitutional rights. But people are so afraid of the uniform, the gun, the organization, the courts, the fine process, that they will respond they'll back down. But in some cases, people will not back down. And that is apparently what happened to the police force, certainly in the case of a number of people like Alex and Joff. You may have seen the large 6x3x3 artist free display, which has a lot of paintings on it, which Joff and I guess it was Alex. It's his display, but Joff had an adjacent display. Alex would not put it within he would not stop selling it. He would, I think he was trying to make, you know, some understanding with the police, but he finally reached the point where he simply set it up, and he didn't feel he had to set it up within the little blue pins that were provided. He says, the First Amendment activity, I can do it anywhere where I'm not clearly, you know, obstructing, causing a problem. And he also didn't feel he had to move every hour, which again is an unnatural, inappropriate, and abusive and burdensome imposition upon street vendors and street performers, particularly vendors who have to move all their stuff. If it's a heavy stuff, often vendors don't have vehicles. They are, you know, they have bicycles or they're on foot. It takes them a considerable amount of time to set up. In any case, he went to court, and in a strange case, and I don't think it was particularly because of a constitutional savvy or a response to constitutional arguments by Commissioner Kim Basket-level Basket, basement-level Basket, or Basket Case Basket, is what I've called her in the past. She found some other basis for throwing out the case, which had a full trial. I wasn't there, but I heard about it. But in fact, other performers and other vendors began to simply ignore the dots and ignore the stuff downtown, particularly those who had their own artwork. And that essentially was in accord with existing constitutional and court precedent, but essentially ignored by the Santa Cruz Police Department. And so the lament here of Vice Chief Martinez that, you know, they would have to use force to stop these people. They're not, you know, they're not behaving like docile little ducklings as they should. You know, it makes me cry a river of tears for the poor police department. Actually, it makes me feel a kind of pride in the vendors who stood up for their rights. It's not, however, the usual. It's not something we should expect of everyone or of anyone, for that matter, because it's hard to do, particularly if you're regularly employed and you're afraid of losing your job, you know, if you're one rent check away from getting bounced out on the street. There are all kinds of reasons. I mean, you're afraid of getting, you know, physically abused by police or having your property or your artwork confiscated. Anyway, this whole issue of the right not to have your own property, your own artwork, messed with by the police was finally put into this ordinance in a more explicit way. So the police are sort of advised, no, you cannot take someone's paintings, their books, their audios, if that's their own work they're selling. That's something they have a right to do under the First Amendment. You can't claim they go need to get a permit. You can't claim, you know, they got to go get a vending license. And indeed, there's no provision for a vending license under this current ordinance. Although I think that the latest attack by the police was last winter when they were, or before that, they were using the vending license demands on people. And some people went and got vending licenses, although that's a whole other story. In any case, this ordinance also ignores some of what Alex and Joff are doing, which is other First Amendment conscious and aware vendors are doing. And I'm talking about people who are vending their own stuff that is not crafts, not because crafts are any less worthy or any less artistic, but because they haven't yet been covered, as far as I know, by a court decision, although, again, my knowledge of court decisions is limited, mainly to those that are positive and have a good impact on street performers and street artists and street vendors. So this ordinance, as it's currently crafted, as it was being discussed today, or I should say on Tuesday, was being discussed in this particular session of City Council, stated it still insists that people who are vending their own stuff move every hour if they have a table or display device, or if they're seated. It insists that they be within these little bracketed areas, which have been severely cut down in number, although expanded in space from 12 square feet to 24 square feet, which is good, but the thousands and thousands of square feet that are actually available on the sidewalk, that all that should be forbidden territory, is, of course, preposterous and abusive, and is part of a conscious scheme to create the illusion of some kind of reasonable system and freedom of expression without the substance. Let's hear some more. Again, this is Deputy Chief Martinez.
Which isn't as easy as you'd think. And probably the last thing you want is the cops actually interpreting what a performance is. So that's the position we were in. That's why it was so difficult to enforce. In terms of enforcement, I don't think we've ever really been accused of not taking substantial enforcement action. But we were put in a position where we really had to step down on this or really go in and like I said, step up to a level we were going to have to use the use of force. And if we weren't on solid ground, the city as well as our individual officers would face a significant amount of liability. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure that was really the spirit of what this ordinance was about. It was really about, I think, increasing performance, ensuring there was some clarity. But in the end, and maybe just how it was originally put together, it didn't really come to fruition. And
I think that Martinez is doing the usual puff piece thing for the police department and for those who created this ordinance. That was the cover for it, that it was, you know, to help increase performances and make everything more orderly. But in fact, its impact has been, and could easily have been anticipated to be, a crowding of performers and vendors, a essential increase in tensions between police and vendors and others downtown, an unnecessary tool being given to hecklers, or the hecklers in this case being the merchants, or those who are, you know, like the hosts or the private security guards who somehow feel that they have a special license to run around harassing people and saying, you're not following this rule, you're not following that rule. Those who have these rule books, where this particular rule book is ridiculous and abusive. So, and what this really is a commercialization of the downtown, an attempt to implement a kind of merchant agenda and privatization and gentrification of the sidewalks. But, of course, you're not going to hear Martinez saying that.
For us, it put us in a difficult position and one that really would have brought a significant amount of liability onto our community and probably cost us a significant amount of money. To clarify.
Thanks, that was very clarifying.
None of that would have happened, of course, had not performers resisted and said, we have the right to be here. We have the right not to be in these boxes. We have the right to display our own artwork without your heavy-handed thuggery. And in fact, some people did this in a very colorful way. Alex and Joff dressed up as Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin on the sidewalk. So it was the resistance of the people, not the wisdom of the staff or the forbearance of the police or the judiciousness of the Santa Cruz City Council, that made the difference and will make the difference again in the months that come.
As I view this issue, we're trying to balance two things. Creating a marketplace for the vendors who pay a lot of money. I mean, they really contribute to our town in huge ways, and we want to make sure that they have, you know, the ability to succeed. And
by vendors, he, I think, means the people who are in the shops.
And we're also trying to create sort of a free arts scene on Pacific, which is attractive and is in line with our values as a community.
And again, this is a very restrictive view of the purpose of public space in the downtown. The notion that it's okay if it's a nice upper middle class art show for the community, but we don't want to have the riffraff downtown. It isn't a matter of the rights of the community to use the public spaces in ways it chooses to use, whatever creative ways it comes up with, provided they're not, you know, abusive of the health and safety of the community. He is not interested in defending the street culture downtown in terms of the rights of poor people to gather, the rights of different kinds of disfavored groups, youth to gather, people of color, folks who are just want to gather in groups, maybe sit down. There are huge, broad, wide sidewalks. The normal aspects of urban life that happen in different cities are being denied in Santa Cruz, have been for 20 years, actually, under these ordinances, because we have this sort of artsy-fartsy justification from a liberal, that really the justification for allowing people in public spaces, if they produce good artwork, I mean, you're allowed in public spaces, you're transiting, walking up and down, but you can't set up a table and have bad artwork or vend jewelry or anything, or particularly if it competes with the folks in the stores. This seems to be what Posner is saying. And this is our most liberal council member.
And that's a tough balance, for sure. I mean, I certainly think some of the things reinvented, like rocks, are not really, you know, creating a free art scene. In fact, we were up in the mountains recently, and someone was walking around with a mallet, and my kid said, oh, no, are they going to knock out all those rocks and take them to the Pacific?
Hardy, har, har, Micah. And as David Silva, who spoke at the Oral Communications, pointed out later, an activist who came to town decades ago, and apparently when he was just out of the military, he survived by selling jewelry, some of which involved rocks, perhaps. And so the notion this is all to be sneered at and laughed at and beneath consideration, it's part of a desire, I think, on the part of Posner to reach out to the other side, in this case, the fascistic side that decides that we will decide what happens on the sidewalk, you won't, which I think is just the whole, just completely wrong-headed. Let's hear some more.
It's a, you know, God made those rocks. I don't think anyone else made them. On the other hand, you know, something like jewelry, I mean, there is jewelry that's part of the art tour. You know, I mean, jewelry can be a very artistic endeavor that's not utilitarian, so it's a tough call. My recommendation is that we ask the Arts Commission to help us with this, because no matter how we try to parse it, we're trying to figure out what is art. We want art, and we don't want competing commercial sales. And, you know, the artists on the Art Commission spend a lot of time thinking about this, so I think we should run this through the Arts Commission and ask for their help in two things. One, ascertaining where to draw the dotted line about what art is and what isn't. And secondly, I think there should be some kind of ability to question, the ordinance. So, like, if it says that textiles generally aren't art, but you have someone that's making amazing textiles, I think there should be some way that they could, you know, apply to the Arts Commission or the art staff or whatever and sort of get an exemption. Because we think of these artists as traveling through, but a lot of them, like Nina, you know, they live here and they're amazing artists, and we want to encourage them to come down to Pacific. So those are two things I would advise that we get information from the Arts Commission about. And then I agree with Dawn that we really need to think ahead of time about how this will be enforced, and I'm glad that Rick spoke up about that. It seems to me that you know, the biggest disadvantage is if it's hurting the businesses community. So I think we should try to figure out ahead of time, like, an outreach plan about soliciting complaints and how complaints would be handled. I personally don't think it's real.
The biggest thing is not whether it's, and hurting, it might be one thing if there were any proof of that, but offending or annoying the business community cannot be the primary consideration of a council member charged with defending the interests of the entire community. And that's what these council members are supposedly, of course, but not really, charged with doing. It seems to me that Micah, often what he does is he is attempting to imagine what other council members might agree with and frame his arguments that way, instead of looking at what is right, what is true, however unpopular, however unfashionable, however inappropriate to the times, however unlikely to be successful, and basing his arguments on that ground rock of truth. That, to me, is what primarily upsets me about the kind of arguments he makes. And, of course, it's kind of silly that I'm upset, because this is the standard that politicians do, many of them. And I'm upset with Micah because he's a friend of mine, and I hate to see this happening, but I also know that this is the nature of this office that he gets into. But it's completely unacceptable, as far as I'm concerned. And it betrays the public trust and corrupts the public dialogue.
I think I disagree with Dawn a little bit about this, you know, that we would really move someone along every hour. On the other hand, it should be easy for someone to complain and say, this person's been here 7 hours and they're torturing me. You know, and there should be a way, like parking enforcement does it, where, you know, there's some, and I think it'd be the downtown host that would, you know, take a watch and check the time and write the time down and go back and decide it's been an hour and ask the people to leave. If they didn't leave, then call the police. So,
and here we have, again, the corrupted rule that was previously an understanding among performers for 22 years with the Voluntary Street Performers Guidelines from 1980 to 2002. Which essentially said that you perform or vend or whatever for an hour. It had to do with performing, really. And then if somebody wants you to move, whether it's a merchant who's tired of hearing the same song or of another performer who wants a good, particularly valuable space to take or whatever, then you would, as a matter of respect for the kind of the peer group that you're a part of, do so. And I know Tom Noddy, who is an activist involved with this, felt this worked very well, and I've kind of taken the lead in without carefully examining stats. The only opposition I've heard from this was from former council member and Mayor Mike Rotkin, who didn't give me opposing stats either. So, but I never noticed real problems with this voluntary guidelines that people had. But they were turned into laws in order to, pander, to pander to merchants led by Bunny Shoes and other businesses downtown in 2002, and this move-along law became something that law enforcement officials or law enforcement-minded officials could use, and also other people could use just for the hell of it. And it was also used against political activists rather severely. It was used against me and Huff. It was used against Steve Argue. Never against, of course, establishment politicians who could sit there all day with their tables. So it's just a complete recipe for selective enforcement. And it's also a way of essentially thinning out Pacific Avenue. And that's really, I think, what a lot of these ordinances are about. So it would be great if somebody actually attacked this head on and said, let's return to the voluntary street performers guidelines. And that's what I suggest we do until we find something better. And there are probably are better solutions, too. And let's not pussyfoot around about this whole thing, but say this is what there should be a downtown ordinance review on. I would have liked to have seen a specific motion from Posner to eliminate the move-along law. With some strong evidence against it, would have been very popular to do that, I think, at least among performers and vendors, and I think on numbers of the community as well.
It seems like, clearly, in hindsight, we need to get more of that work done ahead of time before we just got into the abstractions about it. So those are my two recommendations. One, that we go to the Arts Commission to help us figure out this dilemma about what's art and what's just selling stuff, as well as a way that people could appeal it. And then secondly, that we work closely with the Downtown Commission and the police before we come back to, ahead of time, have an idea about how this will be, how whatever ordinance we pass will be enforced.
Both of these were rejected sort of out of hand, even without a vote, by Cynthia Matthews, who is running things according to her own little zippity-zop stopwatch. There was no determination to go to the Arts Commission, to go to the Downtown Commission, or to go to the Police Department on the obvious enforcement problems they were having. And so what's going to come back in 2 weeks is just more of the same. And it's going to be, I think, pretty much, as I said, a rubber stamping process. What should we be doing in the next 2 weeks? Well, I've been hitting the streets asking for input from vendors and asking if they're interested in forming a vendors union or a vendors guild or a vendors organization. And a few have said yes. And that might be a way to go, although this is not an easy thing to do. It's certainly not for street performers. We've tried it a number of times. 2003, this SAFE Forum, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression. There was an earlier group that Tom Noddy and others worked with and created money for, but never spent any of that money on in terms of legal cases, although he's often said, well, no one's ever come to me and asked about it, and I'm not suggesting any corruption or problem there. It's just there's been no aggressive attempt to defend the rights of street performers. And having an organization of street performers is a difficult matter because it's street performers are not one that sit around having meetings and so forth. They want to perform, and often it's a matter of survival performing. And that's one of the things also I just noticed in this discussion. Vend things, sell things. Well, some people have to sell things in order to survive. And they could never afford a license. And the notion that you're going to drive people away and drive poor people out who are, on the edge of destitution because you don't like the way they look downtown, or that there's some big problem with garage sales coming downtown, is ridiculous. There's been no such influx. So these are the kinds of boogeymen that were used, and Cynthia Matthews was pretty good about this kind of stuff. She was it was one of her fancies. Was to say, well, what if this, we need to have a move-along law, because what if there's a bad performer and no one can move him along because he won't go voluntarily? That's what she was saying in 2003 when this issue came up originally as a law rather than as a simple agreement between street performers as a voluntary guideline. I'm going to be talking more about this on Sunday, and it's going to require, I think I'm going to go through more of this city council meeting. Maybe I'll have Tom Noddy on. I'm going to see if I can reach him by phone. I don't think he's been too much into the vendor scene, but he has been involved with street performers, and has a strong interest in this. He's been on the show many a time, and if you want to look on the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, under the show, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, and under the category of descriptions, you can find... Look for the name Tom Noddy, Noddy. You'll find some of his old interviews, and they really still hold up very well. And they're all about the value and effectiveness of the street performers' guidelines, the voluntary street performers' guidelines, not laws that threaten you with $250, $350 fines if you don't move when the guy with the gun and the badge or the uniform and the badge shows up and tells you to shape up.
Hi, this is Phil Oakes.
State with Jim Glover of Jim and Gene, who was my roommate and taught me how to my first chords. We used to sing together.
Black girl, don't lie to me. Tell me where did you stay last night? In the pines where the sun never shines. And I shiver.
One of the first jobs I got was right after I started in 1961, was in Farragher's, or the Dalton Boys Saloon, up in Cleveland. At that point, I was doing some Kingston Trio kind of songs, and I was writing my very first straight topical songs.
And he left us in the crowd.
The very first song I wrote was about the Cuban invasion. I learned a few chords. I learned like an E minor and an A minor. The first one was the Ballad of the Cuban Invasion, which is something like this. So.
A thousand went to take the island. A chance as strong as broken twigs. A thousand stayed there at the island. Met their fate at the bay's bend. They were told when they arrived, the island would come to their aid. They found out those who survived, there was no hope they were betrayed.
Songs like, Billy Solestes was a Texas millionaire that was got caught in a scandal and had to go to jail. Something to do with fertilizer, I believe. But this was a song about the government attitude about a guy caught and how they dropped him. Something like this.
Stand tall, Billy Saw, we don't know you at all. Take down those pictures from the wall. Well, we don't want to handle an agriculture scandal. We have got to face elections in the fall.
They brought a whole bunch of people through that particular summer. The Smothers Brothers came. Novel Cover 10,000, just everybody came through that particular set. And I was opening act for all those people, so it was really a fantastic experience as a performer. Because I literally had been playing the guitar for a couple of months and doing those little ditties. Bob Gibson had a big influence on me. He never seems to figure out what it is, but you know, it's a kind of sort of bouncy kind of music with a little, you know, a certain kind of chord structure. You gave me this melody.
Up, two, three, four, marching down the street, rolling of the drums and the tramping of the feet. General salutes and the mothers wave and weep. Here comes the big parade. Don't be afraid. Righteous paid one more parade. So young, so strong, so ready for the war, so willing to go and die upon a foreign shore. All march together, everybody looks the same, so there is no one you can blame. Don't be ashamed, light the flame, one more parade.
I was writing songs about Vietnam, you know, before there was any peace movement. I mean, like the first songs were about Vietnam, about 1962 and 63. Yeah, even when Kennedy was still around.
Well, I don't really care to die for the new frontier and make Vietnam safe for democracy.
And of course, I ain't marching anymore. I'll just do a bit of that. So. See, at this point, I'd moved to New York City. I was living in the Village, living near the corner of Bleecker McDougal, and this song came out one night.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. Young land started growing, young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leader's screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason. Call it love or call it reason.
And the rest is history. Minor history with history.
If you didn't protest, who or what would you be?
If I didn't protest, I'd still be a writer. I'm always, my main interest is writing. Anything I can.
When you think of America, do you think that we're in a lot of trouble? You point out different things that are wrong.
That's a loaded question. When I think of America, I think America is, America's got a lot of things. You know, they got money, they got space, they got natural resources. But, you know, the basic thing I think there's one drastic thing wrong with America, terribly wrong, which is American foreign policy. I think American foreign policy is, at best, adventurous and overambitious, and at worst, criminal.
And that's a little bit of a YouTube item about Phil Oakes, who I usually play a lot of songs from, but I'm getting a little tired of playing the same old 40-year-old songs, although they're good. I like them. I think some of the background is interesting, and when I find it, as I have here, I'm passing it on to you. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. And you're listening to Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the April 14th edition. I'm Robert Norris. If you have comments about this show, you won't be able to go on the air today, but in the future. 423-4833 is the number locally. 831-423-4833 is the number most everywhere else. So let's listen to a few interviews from the street from vendors who are still on Pacific Avenue. This was... I think this was yesterday, actually, Wednesday the 13th of April.
I'm on the streets here with artist and dog walker Coral Brun. Hello, Coral.
Hello.
And you say that one of your friends at the tannery is having his artwork censored at the library?
Yes, it's somewhat resolved, but it would be Lisa Silas and Matthew Riggs. And they were doing some public announcements about the fact that the library recently took down their art. They broke their art.
And
so, it's the food. There's a guy on Front Street. No.
What kind of art was it?
They were classic nudes. They have the Neoteric Renaissance Art School at the tannery. And they teach drawing and sculpting. And they have, you know, profound works. They had these drawings, and the library gave them a show, had a time to show them, you know, the whole month of, I think it was February or January. Oh, no, I've got lunch. No, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah,
you have done it.
The woman
passing around
the lunches. Apple cider.
Okay.
Sure.
Every Wednesday.
Oh,
that's very nice.
No, but thank you. I should interview you later on your work.
Your work?
Your play.
And just as an aside, this is a woman who's giving out sandwiches downtown and drinks. And this was midday Wednesday, a little past noon. There is a noon meal at the St. Francis Soup Kitchen for those who meet the standards of the kitchen. I'm not sure what the standards are these days. I haven't heard anything particularly discriminatory recently. There are no longer meals available at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, in keeping with its appropriate name, unless you're in one of their programs. And if you're in one of their programs, you're probably not one of the people who need the meals. Well, everybody needs to eat. And the reason I mention is because about 5 minutes before I passed somebody who asked for some money for food, which I didn't give him, being part of the standard, oh, they're just a bunch of panhandlers downtown mentality, which unfortunately I all too frequently share.
Standing downtown, and I was starting to say that as far as having public art, Lisa and Matt are just distressed because the public library had a complaint from one of the patrons or one of you, somebody that went in there.
Too much penis.
Yeah, well, it's blaming it on his son, saying, oh, you can't look at things like that. Whereas they had erotic art books nearby where this supposedly happened. It's an educational place.
Is this an erect or a flaccid penis?
Yeah, I don't recall. No. Somebody broke the glass on it.
And when was this all happening?
It's happened this year, I think in February.
And what was the response of the library to this critic?
That they needed to take down just that piece, maybe. But in the meanwhile, someone on the staff who didn't know how to take the art down and didn't call them to say, hey, we had a complaint, broke the glass in their frame.
Because they were upset with the penis.
Yeah. Well,
or was
it
a vagina, perhaps?
No, I think they were both male and female drawings. Sketched, you know. Mind you, it's art.
So what happened? Was his artwork vandalized, or...?
Yeah, it needed to not look like it was damaged, so she doesn't like ever stuff returned damaged.
What was the damage?
They broke the frame and they broke the glass.
And the main library?
Yes. You can get the story confirmed there that this indeed that they had a show scheduled, and because all that happened, she didn't feel respected. She went and took an entire show down. And then put all the facts online about it, you know, on her mailing list.
And where can people find this information?
At Lisa Silas.
Spell that.
Lisa, like L-I-S-A, and last name is S-I-L-A-S. She has the Neoteric Renaissance Art Gallery.
And where is that?
1050 River Street, number 126.
Well, that sounds clear enough.
Yes.
We've been talking with?
Coral Broom.
Thank you, Coral.
Thank you very much.
So we're talking with Dan Ray, who is patting a pooch and also sitting next to his prints and handmade originals outside the blue brackets. Although only very slightly outside the blue brackets. But you say, Dan, you've already been warned.
Yeah.
You'll be ticketed if you stray beyond an hour here.
That's what they said today.
Who told you that?
One of the officers, I forget her name, but she's with First Alarm. So not technically a police officer. But
now, have you ever been ticketed before here?
No, but they keep on threatening. They've been threatening for the past month.
And are there other people who are chomping at the bit to take your space?
Nope. No, there's a space open right down there, so I haven't had that problem before.
And how long have you been doing this kind of displaying on the city?
Since December. I come down from Portland once or twice a month.
And for how long do you stay?
I usually get stuck here. It's kind of hard to get out of here if you don't want to pay to get out, so I usually get stuck down here for about a week or two, but I don't mind getting stuck here.
Make enough to move on?
Yes, yeah. Enough to travel. Be semi-comfortable.
Well, there's some people who are trying to organize a vendor's guild around here to defend the rights of vendors. What will be your response to
that? That sounds like a great idea. I think we need it.
Do you have a phone and an email you want to add to that list?
Yeah, I do. Not on the radio, but
okay, we'll take that off air. Any other thoughts before we go?
Maddie's awesome. Right over there.
She's a worker. She's a printer as well?
She's just a rad lady. She works around here, but yeah. I do want to say about First Alarm, they keep on making false threats just to intimidate us.
Well, I'm here at a small square table, which is legally placed inside the blue brackets. However, our man's seating display is outside the blue brackets, which isn't illegal yet, but soon will be. Maybe it is, but they aren't enforcing it at the moment.
I haven't heard anything about where the seat is, just that the table and display must be within the box.
And what has been happening recently that you think is worthy of our attention?
Well, very recently I was on the news, two nights ago. Myself, Alex, and Jeff, at least us three, were on the news.
Your name is?
James. Yeah, and some interesting stuff. And
what was on the news?
Oh, it was basically them just asking us questions about what was going on. And I just gave them my little spiel.
What did you tell them was going on?
Honestly, I forget. You can watch the news.
Well, what is going on? I'll ask you that.
There we go. Well, what's going on right now is police have said that they're going to start enforcing the moving 1 hour, moving every hour policy.
Move along
every hour, which I think is it's just too much. Now, I would be okay with moving, like, maybe twice a day, once a day, I don't know. But ultimately, I think they should really just rework the whole thing or get rid of it altogether. The police have stated that they're going to re-implement or whatever, start enforcing the policy, the movement policy. But so far, all they're doing is harassing us. They come by and say, okay, it's time for you to move, and then I don't see them again. So I'm not really sure what their gig is. I also heard from another source that they're not actually going to be enforcing it until June or something.
Well, there's a consideration before City Council. Yes. Last night, they proposed a draft ordinance, which comes back in 2 weeks for a first vote, to be followed 2 weeks later by a second vote, to be followed a month later if it's passed by presumably enforcement if they want. So that's the timeline. But the move-along law has been a poison pill for years on Pacific Avenue, though I don't think because of the resistance of yourself, John, and Alex, and others to the, I call them performance pens, and the other kind of extreme restrictions on performance, vending, tabling, and so forth. I think they've been sort of somewhat derailed in their attempt to homogenize and commercialize a downtown.
Yeah, and thank goodness, because I see a lot of corporations moving in. And if they want to keep this place autonomous, they need to not accept corporate influence. Now, it seems to me that, there's a dead end on the influence trail. As in, like, the city council and the city manager, they receive, influence or input from some group that basically tells them what to do. And attorneys have followed it back and back, and then it just ends. I feel strongly, I don't know if it's totally true, but I feel strongly that it's certain businesses attempting to influence city council.
Have you actually got any particular named businesses you wish to point out?
I do not know. But it seems to me that there are certain businesses. I have had, when the police come and talk to me, I've only been really asked, told to move, where I was going to get a ticket once. Well, twice. It was in the same day.
Did you move?
I was about to not, but I realized that what was going on is I had attracted a crowd, of undesirables, i.e. hippies with backpacks and dogs.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Which I don't think is technically illegal, immoral, or...
It's unsanitary, we know that.
Absolutely, yes. Hippies are dirty. but anyway, so what happened was, I saw another fellow down the way. He was playing his guitar, and he was about to leave, so I was like, well, okay, I'll move. And so I went down there. The crowd followed me. And then the officer came to me and said, well, you know, actually right now it's just complaint based. So, I mean, just, you know, it's like, it's because of all these people, the reason I'm even talking to you.
The fact that you're a popular and creating a community downtown or an interest in what you're doing, that's not acceptable. If you would move at the commercial pace and direct people into the stores, it might be better.
It may be. That's probably what they're going for.
Well, that could be your new role.
Yeah.
Shop at Forever 21.
I don't want to tell my true view on it about Forever 21 and all the other corporate businesses. I don't want to turn anybody away from your show. But I really think that...
A major sponsor is Forever 21, so we would urge you to praise them with every third sentence if possible.
The problem is corporations are destroying America. What happens is we give them money, it goes into a big account, sometimes overseas. A lot of these corporations only exist here to extract money from the populace and don't want to give anything back other than the look of being Hollywood.
Specifics about Santa Cruz, because that's really what we're talking about.
Okay, well, yeah, I think that Forever 21 and Gap and certain other businesses are basically detracting from a small town, hometown, real town attitude and vibration, but, you know, atmosphere rather.
Now, would you be interested in joining a vendor's guild?
That might be interesting. It depends on how it's set up. My friends and I have talked about it before. It's really hard to, I don't know if I want to use the word hard, but it would have to be done really correctly. You know.
And we've been talking with?
James.
Thanks, James.
Well, listen, you've been writing and performing for several years.
Phil Oakes interview.
At the club. Maybe 55 times, but you've never performed there. Why?
Well, because you never asked me to perform when I needed the break.
When you needed the bread.
You know, when I needed the break and the exposure, you know. It was a commercial club then, and I wasn't commercial.
You're now...
Now I'm commercial by default.
By default?
Because I'm still alive and performing after all these years.
How does that make you all of a sudden commercial?
Well, because most folk singers are gone someplace else.
You started to say most think.
No, well, that was, of course, I haven't.
Okay, go ahead.
And most folk singers and most finks have disappeared.
All folk singers.
Yeah, and they joined rock and roll groups, you know, and so I'm still here.
That's true.
And I haven't changed over the years. I'm just as dull as ever. So.
Oh, come on. Listen, I just recently I was on the coast, right, Phil? We were both there together, and you were doing a great promotion with posters all over the place. You even enlisted me to place them all over Malibu. What
right.
was that all about? Why don't you tell everybody?
I got involved with the politics of the absurd in California, which is it was a theater demonstration in which we declared the war over in Vietnam and celebrated the end of the war on June 23rd in Los Angeles. We celebrated the end of the war, and we're going to probably do that in New York sometime soon also, just as a theater piece. And we have a poster which says that, a picture of the sailor kissing the girl from Times Square, VE Day.
It's one of your protest ideas. I mean, you're
Are
you known as a protest folk singer?
Yeah, I am.
You know, I know, that's great.
Which is a dirty lie. I've never protested.
I think it's great. You write always about current things, I notice. For instance, did anything happen yesterday that you wrote about today?
Oh, let's see. I wrote about the ballad of Louise Day Hicks. I finished late last night.
Late last night, right?
And,
that's great. Listen, what are you going to sing tonight? Because so many great songs you have.
Well, I've got a couple. I'll do one oldie but goodie from the old days, which is called My Dropped Flat Pick.
Your dropped flat pick. That's one.
Otherwise known as There But For Fortune.
Yeah.
And then the other one will be a song I wrote after I saw you in California. A song written after a demonstration, which it's a song which declares the war over. It's a new kind of song. It's not a protest song. It's a different kind. Futuristic political song, which goes into some aspects of the surreal and hopefully inevitable. The war is over. There is no more war. It's all figment of some maniac imagination. Silent soldiers on a silver screen, framed in fantasies and
drugged in dreams, unpaid actors of mystery. The mad director knows that freedom will not make you free. And what's this got to do with me? Just to blind the blind, poison players of a grisly game. One is guilty, and the other gets to point the blame. Pardon me if I refrain.
I'm on the line with Nick Valiach of the 13-member Santa Cruz County Cannabis Cultivation Choices Committee. That's the C4 committee tasked with the developing recommendations on the regulation of cannabis cultivation in Santa Cruz County. And I became a little alarmed this actually a couple days ago reading an online story from Santa Cruz Indie Media suggesting that the group is voting to recommend the ban on the sale of Santa Cruz homegrown pot by a reported 11-2, also a new tax measure for a November 2016 ballot. But I have on the line Nick, who says there's another meeting today, Tuesday the 12th of April, where some of these issues may be clarified or even reversed, at least insofar as they're described here. Is that accurate, Nick?
Yeah, I can't say on how the meetings today are going to evolve, but if people want to stop by at 12:30 over there at the Simpkin Center, it will probably be a pretty entertaining meeting. But some of these things that were decided, that are cited in that news article you're talking about, I think they might get revisited today. And so it's hard to... I wouldn't say that that article has cast anything in stone. I necessarily wouldn't say that it's wrong either, but I just think there's the meeting in which that was decided on was a very chaotic meeting, very long, and some things came out of it that I think some people didn't think that's what they wanted or so. So that's, I would say that's still up in the air. Now, as far as like the homegrown, that's still a tough issue because what we're trying to do is to figure out how it fits in with the home occupation license pass that I think the county has. So, for example, if people want to have a little home business, the issue is whether or not cannabis would fall under such a category.
And what's your personal take on that?
My take initially was against it, but there's been some people that have come to the meeting, public members, that I think have brought up very good points. And what I've told them is that I'm keeping my mind very open on it, and I'm thinking about it. What I wanted to do is I want to be in sync with how the county does it with other home occupation businesses, and I wouldn't want to all of a sudden start creating opening the floodgates where people are doing all kinds of different businesses in their home, which really might not be fitting for a neighborhood. But I think there might be an opening here, and I'm keeping an open mind on it. I can tell you I voted no on it when it was proposed, and I explicitly stated my reasons, but I also explicitly stated that I'm keeping a very open mind on it, and I want to study it a little bit more.
Any further information on deputy attacks on marijuana grows?
I haven't heard anything about them.
Okay, would they have come up?
And again, I'm the wrong person to ask on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see if you can give me some other contacts. I was asking you about that.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anything from you on that. So if you can, that would be helpful. This is, there's a split.
But the big thing I would say is this meeting today of the C4 meeting is, it's a big one. And I believe the supervisors today have on their consent agenda, which they are, might only be informational only. I didn't get a chance to watch the meeting this morning of the supervisors, but they're looking at the report that came out of our committee.
And there was a meeting both of the supervisors and of the C4 group 2 days ago on Tuesday, and I did a longer interview with Nick today for this show, which I won't be able to play in its entirety because I don't have time. I'm going to be able to play a part of it, and I apologize to listeners for not getting a lot of clarity on this homegrown stuff. Bit under the weather these days, and so I'm not always picking up on things, but doing what I can. I think it's an important issue. I encourage people to follow it. And you may get some contact information at the end of Nick's interview, although, again, my view about this group I expressed to Nick quite clearly, the one he's working with, is it's essentially a fig leaf for the NIMBYs and prohibitionists in the community who want as little to do with marijuana as possible and want to treat it as some sort of toxic weed that has to be very carefully regulated and fenced off and so forth.
From March 29th, which is the one that issue from the news article that you quoted. So it looks like that the supervisors might be accepting it, might be pulling it for comment. I'm not sure if they did. But either way, I still think that article could be premature.
And I don't know whether there was a recommendation to ban homegrown marijuana, requiring a 10-acre minimum to grow commercially. That's, of course, a real serious question. There is, however, a Board of Supervisors, a County Board of Supervisors meeting coming up, as mentioned, on the 19th, which is going to vote in or out this crap. Maybe a first reading, maybe even just a first look, like we had with the Vanish the Vendors Ordinance at City Council last Tuesday. I'm not sure, but you can get more information by contacting the Board of Supervisors or going online and calling up.
Or it could just, maybe premature is not the right word, maybe it's incomplete.
Are decisions being made today at the Board of Supervisors?
Not really. I think what's going to happen is the harder decisions look like they might be made in the upcoming supervisor meeting, and then from my understanding, and I'm not sure if this is correct, but my understanding is that supervisors will probably be giving some direction at the next meeting, and then you're going to be seeing some hard decisions made sometime, I'm guessing, in May. That's just guessing, by the supervisors.
Okay.
Those will be the bigger decisions, which are all of a sudden start becoming the fine details, which could dramatically change things. Could dramatically change recommendations that come out of C4. They could be in sync with what comes out of C4, but it does not take much of a tweaking to greatly affect a particular person or particular parcels, anything like that.
You know, my real question for you, and that's what I guess I'd like, if you can get this kind of information, is hard documentation, not just anecdotal grumbling about the actual abuses that are justifying this C4 committee in the first place, and again, what I brought up to you before is, why aren't the growers simply putting together their own initiative, which I'm assuming the growers aren't really interested in banning home use or home growth, even for, you know, very small business activity.
That would be a better question for a grower.
Right, but the growers have representation. C4 committee voted apparently to do that at this tumultuous meeting you mentioned about. And I accept your sense that today's meeting, which will be a couple of days in the past when I play this event,
what the vote that's kind of being reported in that article is a little bit tricky too, because the vote shows in the articles like 11-2 vote, but that didn't mean that 11 was supporting each and every item. What you had was, there was a bunch of items voted on, which some of them were split votes, like a 7-6 vote, and then when you had it all as a package, then it was the acceptance of the package, even though there's an understanding that some of those members that voted in support of the package did not support individual items of the package.
Yeah, but the idea is, you know, if you're talking about the usual legislative process, you may not, you know, unless you vote against the final product, you're supporting the whole package, whether you didn't like it originally, part of it, or not. Still, you're on board for the general, you know, the ass-whooping later.
I think what you would end up happening is, if I followed that, I think you would end up with a 13-0 vote against everything. So, I mean, otherwise you would have to vote eight.
And what Nick is, I think, missing here is that if they voted against home grows, unless you got 10 acres, which I'm not sure they did, but this article on Santa Cruz Indy Media, which talks about the issue, is group votes to recommend ban on sale of Santa Cruz homegrown. And it's by the San Lorenzo Valley News.net. Group votes to recommend ban on sale of Santa Cruz homegrown pot. Also recommended new taxes, ban on GMO, provisional licensing scheme. 13-member C4 committee tasked with developing recommendations, recommending a ban on all GMO cannabis and almost all homegrown plants. Cultivation strictly for medical use, no sale or donation would be allowed with some restrictions. Also recommended giving licensing priority to growers and sites where cultivation has occurred prior to January 1st, 2016, with a provisional licensing program for grows that meet, quote, basic standards. And then here's the sentence in question: by a reported 11-2 C4 members also voted to recommend a new tax measure for the November 2016 ballot. Well, actually, that's not the relevant. So the 11-2 vote was not for the homegrown, but it was the final vote. And his his suggestion that, well, we got to vote for something at the end because everybody had different views. Well, if you vote at the end for to ban home grows, you vote at the end to ban home grows. It's really as simple as that, and you can't, you know, you can't laugh your way around that one. And if that's what comes out of this committee, again, it seems to give more weight to the supervisor's prohibitionist mentality. Although growers have shown that as a group they can kick the ass of the supervisors down the road by turning back their recommendations with a proposed referendum, which they did last summer. So all is not lost, but see, they've been kind of, I don't want to say they've been bought off necessarily, but they've been put on this committee, so that in a way they would be voting against some of their own representatives, and I suspect that's the strategy of the Board of Supervisors, or those in the staff of the board that want to see restrictive marijuana cultivation standards.
Individual item as a thing, say we approve this, and then how do you end up packaging it all together?
I don't know, but I know that if poison pills are included in the package and you vote for the package, you vote for the poison pill.
I would agree with that. But I mean, either way, the thing is, I would say we had an understanding or agreement that, look, we're going to work on, we understand that there'll be, because there's difference of opinions, obviously, there's some people coming in from totally different angles. I would say I came in kind of like a fence straddler and needed to be tipped based on getting knowledge that I didn't have on the issue. So I kept the open mind on it, and at certain times I tipped in favor of the industry, and certain times I tipped against. So, I mean, would I then, the times where I might have tipped in favor of the industry and the vote goes against it, should I then say I'm against the whole package? I don't feel I should. I mean, unless there was something in there, if there was something in there that I consider so draconian, that, like you're talking about, the poison pill in there, at that point I would myself say I cannot support this.
Well, I guess the issue is whether you feel that a ban on GMO cannabis and almost all homegrown plants isn't draconian is going to be the issue. I mean, it may be that this article is not accurately describing it, or it may be that it is. So,
well, I mean, the homegrown, like I said, the homegrown with me on why I, and I'm clear about this, I even talked to some of the people that were in the audience that were coming from the homegrown angle. I specifically talked to them and said, look, I am trying to make sure that I'm being consistent with my thinking of how I'm doing other things. If I can find the consistency there in a fair manner, that I think they have a good case. And I just said, I'm starting to lean their way, I'm just not there yet, because I don't want something where all of a sudden it creates a chaotic system for others.
Well, as I remember from our last conversation, you had some real concerns that coming out of this whole group could be a rather serious, unnecessary, and strong set of restrictions on cannabis cultivation. So even if you do begin to lean their way, that doesn't mean the C4 committee is going to lean their way.
Correct. And then again, remember, all C4 is a recommending body.
Well, I thought they were, protective cover for the Soup's right-wing agenda. That's been, my general sense. Am I wrong about that?
I think, to me, it seemed like what happened was is the Soups got the surprise of their life because the industry got together and did a referendum.
Right.
And then the Soups, as you're well aware, I mean, how this works is you form a committee. A lot of times you form a committee when you want to stall. And I think and this is just guessing on my part, is that I think the Soups decided to form a committee. They thought they would buy some time, get everybody to quiet down a little bit. At the same time, the state was working on their bills that ultimately were signed by the governor, which changed a lot of things, because now you have the state actually saying, this is what you can do, these are the type of licenses you can do. So hence, the Soups can kick back, let a committee iron out some of the details, and then come back with a recommendation that is going to be in sync, hopefully, with some of the things passed by the state.
No, I take it, I haven't examined how restrictive the state regulations are and how much they, I don't know, impact something like Proposition 215, which is, of course, the broadest mandate for medical marijuana of any state that we have. And I'm going to be, I guess, I'm going to let you go so you can get to, you know, prepare for your meeting and, you know, enjoy your brunch or whatever you're doing. But I'd like, you know, I mean, I think if you can give us a description in our in the next interview we do about not just what happened at this 12:30 meeting, which I can't get to, and nobody who's listening to this will be able to get to.
Okay.
No. But, you know, if we can talk about what the actual background for the state is. And I guess I don't think the voters, while they have, for example, had the referendum fight back against a supervisorial series of crackdowns on marijuana cultivation, what kind of, I guess the only initiative at a state level is what? A referendum of a requiring a huge amount of money and output against the state law, which
I know. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. The only thing from, and state law, there'd be better people to discuss state law than I. But the only thing that I have heard as far as what's in the works at a state level are initiatives. I think there was a few bantered about.
And the next interview I have with Nick, which I did today, but again, as I said, don't probably have time to play much of it, if any, I realized that if the state law violates Proposition 215, it's simply invalid and therefore doesn't apply. So all this scurrying around to address the state law is begging the question of whether the state law is Proposition 215 compatible. And I haven't examined the state law. I've just gotten sort of vague descriptions of it. But that, of course, is one of the issues.
I'm not sure if you started yet. I haven't looked into that. But that would be for recreational.
Right. But, I mean, I'm wondering, we really need to know is what are these restrictions? How do they slice into Proposition 215? And how do they impact local prohibitionist mentalities at a local level, which are, you know, raising their nasty heads all over the state?
I'm not an expert on the state laws. I've read the state laws. It's been some time since I looked at them because I've been devoting more time to this aspect. But it seems from how I recall that the state laws still gave the local jurisdictions the power on whether or not they want to allow such cultivation or dispensaries.
See, now, if that's the case, it's important, I think, to realize that the power really is in the hands not of the Board of Supervisors and not of, oh, we have to get everything lined up the way they have their local business rules at the current time and blah, blah, blah. But you have the power to actually create reasonable regulations for this particular plant, this particular long decriminalized plant, which, you know, is the whole basis on which the supervisors are acting, other than the concerns about environmental problems, is horseshit, as far as I can see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that being the case...
Well, I mean, the power it does, it's going to end up, it belongs, in a way, to the people. So the people have the power of referendum, power of initiative, state level or local level. And then, so it's the people that are going to have a big power here. If they don't like what comes out of, again, it's not going to be what comes out of C4 because C4 is only recommending.
You know, this has a superficial persuasiveness to it, but it's not really true. The power is not with the people. The power is those who have the organization and the money, and that happen to be the growers at a local level this summer, and good for them, to challenge the bullshit of the bureaucratic machine, which is much better funded, meets regularly, has a huge paid staff, relatively speaking. So the idea that the power is with the people generally is simply not the case. It's true at the most basic level, but organizing that power can be a mighty task, as we have seen from the last 4 or 5 or 6 decades, if you've been around, on all kinds of issues. And so it's really important, even at this recommended level, to make the issues as clear as possible and not buy into the fantasies, restrictions, little liberal bureaucratic boxes that have been set up to confuse and mislead people in terms of requiring them to accept an agenda which, were it explicitly created, they would reject, the prohibitionist agenda. Also, I notice they're putting the growers on the C4 committee, which is one way of forcing them or encouraging them or enticing them, it doesn't force them, of course, to buy into the proposal. So what they can do is, in essence, it's sort of, it makes one worry that they will buy off a few of these growers with regulations and restrictions that cater to their particular businesses, particularly if they're big businesses or been around for a while, and then essentially disenfranchise or exclude the rest of the group. And this is like what happened with the Valerie Corral situation over the last 20 years and her WHAM organization. Originally, she was part of a whole bunch of activists fighting to decriminalize medical marijuana. But once WHAM got set up and accepted and became a part of the establishment, medical marijuana, which we tried to purchase elsewhere, whether, you know, it was the Maple Street Cannabis Club or cannabis clubs that Kate Wells and others tried to set up later, even the liberal city council essentially put in the kibosh. And we've seen recently moratoriums and then prohibitions on future cannabis distribution centers in Santa Cruz, the closing of Greenway. I haven't even followed that. I wish I have, and I hope somebody gets back to me on what is currently happening. Maybe I can actually do it myself if I get it together. So it's a classic strategy of a conservative establishment to let a few newcomers in, and then in order to stop deeper and broader reform. And it was pursued, you know, 1,500 years ago or 1,200 years ago by the, well, 2,200 years ago by the Roman Republic, where they let some newcomers into the Senate's patrician class, the plebeians they called them. But this was done in order to forestall the masses from rising up, who were being displaced by huge absentee landlords and slave-run operations and so forth. We have, you know, I don't know if we have an exactly analogous situation, but it looks pretty similar. And the whole process is pretty well known. So those of us who are observing and keeping an eye on it, and hopefully will be raising our voices around these issues, because the truth in the situation may not prevail in and of itself, but for the truth to prevail at all, eventually, it has to be known. It has to be articulated. It has to be put out there. And that, I hope, is what folks are doing. And frankly, being a part of the C4 committee doesn't put out any truth. It colludes in a process of mystification and obscuring the truth by granting the notion without real justification that meaningful changes are needed in the marijuana laws without indicating what the actual particular problems are with any kind of statistical data. Is there environmental damage? What is it? You know, are the smells destroying the nostrils of the nearby neighbors? Well, let's get the particular accounts. Has massive crime and violence, invaded the neighborhoods because of the marijuana grows? Are there huge fire dangers where people can't get through on the roads? I don't want to hear anecdotes, although, you know, anecdotes, if they're true, are fine. But I want to hear how frequently a problem is happening and if the proposed solution isn't worse than the cure, or if there isn't a better solution, and simply imposing a restrictionist, prohibitionist